So tonight I'd like to talk about the theme of the inner critic, the judgmental mind. Anybody know? Anybody have one of those? Anybody perhaps a little critical, a little possibly high standards, a little nitpicking of people we know and love, ways that we're always on our case, or undermining ourselves in some way? It's a very common phenomenon. In fact, I was walking up to the venue today, and I noticed this voice saying, "I don't know if people really need to hear about this topic. I don't know if it's that important. I mean, really, they've got better things to do than listen to this." I thought, oh, I recognize that voice. What the Buddha called the voice of Mara. Right? This voice of ignorance, really, the voice of delusion in our mind. And this critical, doubting voice came to the Buddha, as you know, as you've probably heard this story. And the Buddha was ardently meditating, practicing, understanding himself and the nature of reality. And as he was very close to fully waking up, the voice in the mind came, the voice of Mara, as it's personified in the tradition. And the voice said, as you probably know, "Who do you think you are to be sitting on this throne of awakening, right, on the verge of waking up? By what right do you take this seat?" That voice sound familiar? Who do you think you are? By what right do you have to be here or to do what you do? Very common, pervasive, insidious voice that undermines our value, our capacity. And so the voice, and the Buddha in his wisdom didn't get into a debate with this voice, with Mara. He just touched his hand to the earth, a very famous kind of mudra, and said, "The earth is my witness. The earth is my witness. I have inherent right to be here." The earth knows that by the very fact that you're a human being. You have every right to be here in this body and wake up. And what's interesting in the text is that wasn't the end of that self-doubting voice of Mara. It came back many, many times. Even after full awakening, that voice, that habit in the mind of self-doubting would arise. So I think we're in good company. So one of the things I like to do before I say too much more about the critic is get to hear the names that you might have for this judgmental, critical voice. Because okay? the names we have for the critic are illuminating in itself of its different facets. So what do you call that nagging, negative, harping voice in your mind? Anybody just shout out? Just shout some names out. Reality? Oh dear, we're really in trouble. Okay, what else? Chatty self? Uh-huh.
The saboteur.
The saboteur, yes. I like the inner saboteur, yes. The what?
Prosecutor.
The prosecutor. I haven't heard that one, huh? Or mom, yes. I always hear that one. Pretty much every group I deliver this talk to, I hear mom. But I like the prosecutor because it has a prosecuting side. We are definitely on the standing trial every day. Ego. Uh-huh.
Insecurity.
Uh-huh.
Confidence.
Hmm?
Confidence.
Confidence,
yeah. The opposite of insecurity.
Uh-huh. The opposite of insecurity. Okay. Uh-huh. Any other terms? Little girl? Uh-huh. Okay. So my favorite is the itty-bitty shitty committee. Because we all know it's not just one little voice in there. It is a committee. It's a subcommittee. there's a boardroom, there's a CFO on our case about our money, and then there's our relationship coach, and then there's a taskmaster, and there's the, you know, there's a whole, you know, somebody on a retreat said, you know, it's like living with a bad college roommate that just follows you around. It's, you know, it's messy, and that was stupid, and you look terrible. And then later in the course, someone said, oh, it's not like a roommate. It's like a whole college dorm. It's like this whole cluster of people that have views and opinions about everything that we do that's not quite right. Sometimes we experience it as a bully, as a killjoy, as an underminer. So it's useful to know what kind of voice and flavor your critic has. And that'll be the theme of the talk, really, is you know, what is our relationship to this voice? How do we know it? How does it manifest? What does it have to say? Where does it arise? What impact does it have? So it also comes as a perfectionist. This idea that we should be perfect. Have you ever met anybody who's perfect? It's not a word that goes well with human beings. We are our beautiful, imperfect, idiosyncratic, quirky. I come from England where people are very quirky. You know, we're ourselves. And so this, with the perfectionism, we have impossibly high standards in which to criticize and reject. Another way the critic manifests is this idea that we're not enough. Anybody feel not enough of something? Not smart enough, not further along in my practice enough, whatever that means. Not where I should be in my life enough. Not wealthy enough, not young enough, not old enough, not cute enough. We live in this bizarre culture of abundance and scarcity. And we live internally with a sense of scarcity often. If we listen to that voice of the critic, we are never enough. And then you might notice that the critic, the critical voice, takes on the flavor of wherever we are. So, you know, if you go into work, then you're not sharp enough. Or if you go into the meditation hall, or you come into Buddhist practice, suddenly you're not mindful enough, or you're not compassionate enough, or you're not generous enough, or you're not deep enough, or you're not spiritual enough. You go into the gym and you're not fit enough. And you go into yoga, you're not supple enough. And you go home to the kids and you're not a good enough parent. So you want to see how this critic takes on the hue of whatever we take up. You know, like we learn an instrument or we learn some art form, and immediately we're criticizing ourselves as if we should be perfect from the get-go. It's rationally, you know, we can see that's not true, but we are so often on our case. Another way the critic manifests is this 20/20 hindsight. Right? It's very easy to have 20/20 hindsight about our decisions and our choices and actions in the past and the people we may have chosen to be in relationship with or not, or, you know, investments we might have made, or actions or careers that we pursued. And then we look back from this present day and we go, wow, that really wasn't the wisest person to be with, or the wisest investment, or the wisest choice. Right? And the critic can often be incredibly unforgiving about choices that we make that, of course, we make at the time with the information that we have, and we always do the best we can. And then the critic, I refer to the critic as a swing door, in that whatever we practice, just as the Buddha said, whatever we incline the mind towards, that the mind becomes. So if we incline our mind towards judging and criticism and fault-finding, that's what we will strengthen. And if we strengthen that internally with ourselves, we most likely will be judgmental of other people. And if we're judgmental of other people, when we get home quietly with ourselves, guess what shows up? So we want to ask ourselves with our practice, with our awareness, what habits am I cultivating? And do I want to support and strengthen this stream of mind that is oriented towards what's wrong, what's not good enough, what's not okay? So with awareness, we can begin to track this voice. And when I first started meditating in the 80s, I had not a lot of self-awareness, I don't think, as we often don't without some guidance and practice. I was a young man. I was in my late teens. I was angry. I was a punk rocker. I was living in London. I had a white mohawk, if you can imagine. Hard to believe. I know, but I did. And I was an anarchist, and was involved in a lot of political activism at the time. And I was railing against anything that I thought was unjust, and whether it's corporations or the government or the oppression that I was seeing around me. And I thought the problem was out there. If we just fix the problem out there, I'd be happy. So please take care of it. And then I stumbled upon this meditation center in the East End of London and learned the practice of mindfulness. And that radical moment where we close our eyes and turn that lens inwards, and we see the voices and thoughts and habits and tendencies and all the ways that we create such a lot of harm for ourselves and unnecessary stress. And so it was a wake-up call, because I didn't realize how much self-hatred I had and how much self-judgment I had and how much I was on my case about everything. I read my journals now back from the 80s, and it's kind of sad to see how cruel I was and unforgiving. And so fortunately, I also learned the other complementary practice to mindfulness, which is the loving kindness practice, which is this turning to ourselves with friendliness, with warmth, with acceptance, with allowing, with forgiveness, rather than condemning. And I think that's actually one of the most powerful antidotes to this critical voice, is that we learn how to turn to ourselves with love, which of course is not easy. This is often the hardest place to turn. I know Tara speaks very beautifully about that a lot, how to radically accept what's here in our own heart and mind. So we want to reflect, what is my relationship to the critic? I do meet people who don't have much of an inner critic. They're very lucky. They're very blessed. And obviously, over time, we can do work with ourselves in a way that the critic isn't so painful. But the reason I talk about this, and the reason I wrote the book, this book that I have, Make Peace With Your Mind, is because I've been working with people for 20 years now as a teacher, as a therapist, as a coach. And when I'm working individually with people, I see that one of the main causes of self-created suffering is the critic, is the way that we're so harsh and critical and cruel and unforgiving and unrelentingly hard on ourselves, that it's a great source of misery, the great source of stress, of depression, of unworthiness. Because the critic's not just some idle thoughts, like, they should paint the walls a different color here, maybe a little nicer lighting. That's just a comment. It might be a critical comment. But when we turn that to ourselves, we're not just orienting towards an action, but we're actually criticizing our very value itself, our very worth and value as a person. So, simple example. So, say, and we've all meditated, right? So you may review at the end of the meditation just what your practice was like. Some of you were sleeping, I noticed. Some of you looked very still, but were probably thinking about work. And some of you were planning your dinner tonight. And we have all kinds of different things that go on when we meditate. And sometimes we're present, in between all that. And so we are a little distracted, focused, obsessing about work or relationship. And that's just a healthy way that we assess. And we need, faculties of assessing and of discernment to be able to evaluate our experience. And then the critic comes in, and rather than just assess the data, the phenomena of what happened, there's also a direct critique on you as a person. So rather than, it was a little distracted meditation, a little sleepy and unfocused, it's more like, well, that was pathetic. I mean, really, you can't meditate. I mean, it's hopeless. I mean, why do you bother? I mean, everybody else here looks really like almost close to Buddhahood, and you're the only one who's just can barely follow your breath. I mean, it's pathetic. Get a life. Very different, right? It lands, it's an attack on our capacity as a person, which is why it's so painful. Because if we listen to that voice as it follows us around in our life, which it does. Right? Any parents here? Anybody had some criticism about their parenting? Yeah. Or whatever it is that you do, athletes, musicians, artists, writers. You know, the critic is there, very close to tell us how we're doing. Teachers, anybody in front of an audience. Oh yeah, right. So we want to listen, we want to pay attention to how the critic manifests. How much do you listen to it? How much do you believe it? Do you actually believe what it says? Do you believe anything that the mind says? The bumper sticker I see a lot in California, don't believe everything you think, is a very important reflection. You know, we think what's happening in our mind is true, but as we know, if we pay attention long enough, we see it's subjective, often distorted, limited, right? And that's very true of the critic, has a limited, distorted perspective on who we are. It's a point of view. It's a bunch of words that we give a lot of authority and power to over time. So you really want to explore what your relationship is to it and how much authority you give it over your assessment of yourself. Because if we give it a lot of time, space, and authority, it will be very undermining. It will be a source of discontent. So we want to notice a difference between the capacity to discern and evaluate and the judging mind that attacks our goodness as a person or attacks the goodness of somebody else. And of course, if we have a strong inner critic, we project it outwards. We think everybody else is judging us in the same way, which is rarely the case. There's rarely anybody harder on ourselves than ourselves. We think if we mess up in public that everyone's, you know, judging and criticizing us, but it's really mostly coming from ourselves. And occasionally it happens. There's a cartoon, there's a couple of people chatting. One says, really feeling my imposter syndrome lately, where you're feeling like a fake, which I think comes primarily from the critic, where we feel fraudulent because our critic is saying we're not good enough, we shouldn't have got the job. If they really found out, they'd fire me. If this person I'm dating really knew who I was, they would leave. Right, so we start feeling like a fraud. I write about this in the book where, you know, a lot of famous people, like Einstein wrote at the end of his life, I feel at times like an involuntary swindler. John Steinbeck, the great author, said, I don't think I can write. I don't know why people read my novels. Meryl Streep, most Academy Award nominated actress, talked about in an interview. She said, I can't act. I don't know why people come to see my films. You know, so when we listen to that critical voice, it undermines, no matter how successful or brilliant you are, if that's what we're giving weight to, we're not seeing reality. And of course, our practice is about seeing what is, seeing through distortion. So this person's saying, really feeling my imposter syndrome lately. What if I'm not as good as everyone says I am? And the other person says, what are you talking about? Everyone says you're the worst, including me. So inner critics, outer critics. If we've given a lot of weight to the inner critic, when we hear the outer critic, of course it will land more easily. So we want to see, where is this voice operating? What triggers it? When does your critic arise? So we get to understand the function of the critic. The critic served us in our early life, as Freud pointed to, as the superego, this part of our ego structure that helped us basically fit into our family and society and the norms and values. It helped us kind of navigate a very difficult scenario. We come into this world very vulnerable, and we need to, you know, fit in so we can optimize love and care and affection, and we shut all that was unwelcome down through shame. That's how the critic works, through shaming. A very powerful force, which is why the critic leads to sense of shame. And then it develops and strengthens over time, and adolescence gets stronger because of that, again, the same need to fit in is very intense. And then once we've left home, that apparatus just stays kind of in a groove. It stays stuck. It thinks it needs to shame us and judge us and criticize us to do something, to engage in action, to fit in. And of course, there are many other ways to move through life without listening to the force of the critic, to get out of bed in the morning, to do good work, to be kind. But we often rely on this voice as the only means to function, to make decisions. So as you're listening to the talk, just noticing for yourself, you know, is this resonating? Do I have a critic? Where does it show up? What does it look like? How much consideration have I given to it? Maybe it's actually running rampant a lot of the time. Maybe it's really undermining my sense of value. So what to do about that? How do we work with that? Right? And so the subtitle of the book, How Mindfulness and Compassion Can Help Free You from the Inner Critic. So we bring up awareness practice. We begin to notice what is happening in my mind. What are the thought streams? What are the patterns and tendencies? What am I telling myself about that I'm not good enough or smart enough or mindful enough? Am I giving that a lot of authority? Notice when it triggers. So back to that thought about how the critic arises. The critic arises usually when we feel vulnerable, and we don't like to feel vulnerable because it's vulnerable. It's a tender place that we're perceiving some kind of threat or risk, and so the critic, one of the places the critic arises most commonly is with vulnerability. Say you're late for a meeting at work with your boss and you're stuck in traffic and you were late for the last meeting and you're worried about how your boss is going to perceive your, you know, punctuality and therefore expression of your commitment to the work. That's a vulnerable situation. Your critic's going to have something to say about that. Why are you late? Why are you always late? Why didn't you get your life together? No, 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 no. Thank you, Mr. Critic, Mrs. Critic. I know I'm late. Thank you. It's not helpful to berate myself. Sometimes I can't predict psychically the traffic. So we notice the critic, we see our relationship to it, we see how much authority we give to it. When I was on retreat, sitting with Joseph, he would ask me at times to count the number of judgments in the day. That's always a fun practice. You should do it tomorrow. How many times do you judge? 123, 469, 851. At some point, it gets ridiculous. It's just, why am I on my case so much? And what's interesting is we let that voice, that negative voice, be quite vocal at times, right? But we'd relate to it very differently if, say we gave all of our judgments. I'll often have people write down their top 10 judgments. And if you're interested in this theme, I suggest you go home tonight. You write down your top 10 judgments. And you reflect on them. And then you share them with somebody. And get a reality check. And ask your spouse, partner, friend, roommate, is this true that I'm a terrible person? Is this true that I'm stupid? Is this true that I'm unlovable? Or whatever your critic is saying. And you know, anybody who knows you will probably say, that's not accurate. It's not true. It's not how I see you. So imagine you gave that list to your best friend and they just walked around with you all day, just for a day. And they just said, that was stupid. And you go, look at your house is such a mess. You're such a slob. I can't believe that. I can't believe you have friends coming over tonight. It's so embarrassing. And look at the way you dress. I mean, gosh, scruff, you know. Look at your hair. I mean, you know, it just, you know, as your critic can do. How long would you put up with your friend saying that? Like a minute, 10 seconds, you'd say, wait a minute, that's not very kind, and that's not very helpful, and go away. Thank you very much. I already know that. You told me yes. I told myself yesterday all those things. But sadly, we let that voice keep droning on in the background, eroding that sense of goodness, value, worth. Which is why we want to pay attention. We want to know when we're judging versus just ordinarily thinking or ruminating. We want to isolate that pattern. Oh, and name it. Oh, judging. Oh, judging is like that. Oh, and it makes me feel like this, right? And the critic isn't just verbal. It has an impact, right? So a good example, I'm writing this book or writing other things, and say I show up to my writing desk in the morning and I'm excited because I love to write and I'm all inspired. And I start writing, and then suddenly I start feeling a little foggy, and suddenly my energy goes, and I start feeling heavy, and I start feeling kind of blah, and I don't want to write, and I'm thinking it's all terrible. And then I ask myself, what happened? I was just so excited to write, and I was inspired, and then suddenly I'm in this kind of collapse, emotional, physical, mental, dull, foggy. And then I remember my friend who I'd shown a chapter to yesterday had said something critical about my work, and that seed got planted. Oh, I can't really write. I shouldn't be doing this. Who am I to be writing a book on the inner critic? And then that thought lands, and I start feeling, you know, defeated, fatigued, heavy, blah, right? So we want to see the critic and manifest in different ways. And sometimes we have to backtrack. We find ourselves in that kind of blah, heavy, foggy, defeated place and go, wait a minute, what might my critic be saying to me that's created this kind of mind state? So we listen, we pay attention, we notice, we name, right? Mindfulness has this beautiful capacity to disidentify, in that when we see something with awareness, it creates a certain space around. We're not so identified, we're not so stuck in it, right? So from judging ourselves to suddenly, oh, look at me, I'm really beating myself up. That's painful. That's not very helpful. I wonder if I can let that thought go, right? That's a very different relationship. There's a little more space, a little more ease, a little more freedom. Sometimes, when I think one of the most effective strategies is humor. You know, it's important to laugh at ourselves. Wavy Gravy, a great clown and activist, talks about, he says, it's important to have a sense of humor. If you don't have a sense of humor, it just ain't funny. And that's true with ourselves. We look at ourselves and, you know, it's good to laugh. We're strange creatures. We all want to be happy, and we do a lot of things that interfere with being happy. Like being hard on ourselves and being unforgiving and critical. When I was on long retreats, I would imagine my judge with this gray wig, you know, like they were the barristers wear in England, and just with a stern face, bad meditator, bad yogi, fail. So I'd ham it up, you know, and if it would judge me about my meditation, I'd say, yes, I'm the worst meditator in the world. Thank you. I know. I'm the worst anything in the world. And just trying to make light of it. You know, the more that I can find a sense of humor, like my critic will tell me, or might tell you, you know, you should get up early in the morning so you can do your exercise and your meditation and your journaling and whatever else you should be doing. And then it also might tell you, you know, in the more coaching voice, that you should rest and rest your body and sleep. And you know, sometimes it's the loggerheads with each other. So when you take your pick, you know, well, I'll snooze today because it's good for my brain to sleep, right? Thank you, researchers. So we hit the snooze button. We skip the meditation and the exercise and all those noble New Year intentional things. And we wake up, and then suddenly our critic has turned from the coach to the bully, to the taskmaster, to God, you're such a slob for sleeping in. I can't believe you're sleeping in. Get a life. And you've already failed on your New Year's resolutions. So sometimes you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. And it's useful to see the humor in that, you know, that it's a no-win situation. Sometimes it's helpful to also see that the critic tends to arise in certain habitual ways around certain activities. I think about where you notice your critic the most. Like one of the ways my critic will remind me that it's there is when I lose things, right? Oh, Mr. Mindfulness. You're here. I'm on my way to teach at Spirit Rock, which is my home center. And, you know, I might be a little late for the class, and I can't find my keys on my cell phone or whatever. And I know that's a good fodder for my critic, you know, who thinks that people who meditate shouldn't lose things. Well, good luck, you know. And so I say to myself, oh, Mr. Mindfulness wins the day again, as I'm fumbling around for my keys. Right? So there's a sense of humor, there's a lightness. We kind of hold our foibles with a gentleness, with a smile, right? Because we're human, and we might lose our keys. And it's a really good idea to have a hook by the front door for your keys that I haven't managed to do in the 51 years of my life. But I know it's a really good idea. I'll probably do it one day. And my critic's reminding me that I should do that one day a lot. Maybe I should listen to it. Mm. Sometimes the critic does have some truthfulness in it. It's not that the critic is necessarily all lies. It's just usually a little distorted. But often it is, you know, yes, I lost my keys. Thank you. That's really helpful. I didn't know that. Anything else? And I'm late for my class. I didn't know that either. Thank you. That's why I'm stressed. Mr. Mindfulness. So, humor aside, you know, this pattern, as I mentioned earlier, is also very painful. It's certainly been very painful for me, painful for students I've worked with. And, you know, I've worked with people who are incredibly battered by their judging mind to the point of, you know, very intense depression, sometimes suicidal. You know, that's that when we get ground down by that negative lens, you know, it's hard to feel a sense of well-being. It's very painful, and that's why I talk about the need for compassion, right? We need to be kind with ourselves. We need to be forgiving for ourselves. This is from Maya Angelou. I came across this the other day, and it really struck me as a good teaching for the critic. She writes, "It is very important for every human being to forgive herself or himself or themselves, because if you live, you will make mistakes. It is inevitable. But once you do and you see the mistake, then you forgive yourself and say, well, if I'd known better, I'd have done better, that's all. If we all hold on to the mistake, we can't see our own goodness in the mirror because we have the mistake between our faces and the mirror. We can't see what we're capable of being." Isn't that great? What are you holding between you and the mirror? Mistakes, foibles, things you did that you regret, but you have no possibility of changing, and you did what you did. Right? So it's so important that we can also forgive ourselves for what we've said or what we've done or things we haven't done, right? Because we're human, and we mess up, and we have moments of reactivity and ignorance, or maybe more than a few moments. And do we chastise ourselves to eternity? Or do we, because this is an interesting thing about the critic. When we're on our case, in the same way that when we're reactive, and we're triggered, the prefrontal cortex goes offline in that our sort of survival circuitry is activated, and we're not thinking clearly. We don't see clearly. So if we're berating ourselves, which in itself is a form of activation, then there's not much chance of learning and growing and understanding and resolving and moving on, because we're caught in this vicious cycle of feeling reactive and punished. Right? Just back to the, there's another quote from Kristen Neff. If I can find it. She says, "You don't want to beat yourself up for beating yourself up in the vain hope that it will somehow make you stop beating yourself up. Just as hate can't conquer hate, only strengthens and reinforces it. Self-judgment can't stop self-judgment." Right? The self-judgment, we think, if I just berate myself and I'm hard on myself, I won't do it again. No, we'll just be harder on ourselves. Self-judgment gets in the way of reflection. Of inquiring, now why did I do that? Why did I say that was so mean or unthoughtful? What was going on? Maybe I was jealous, or maybe I was threatened, or maybe I was just blindsided. Right? So the judgment interferes with curiosity. And one of the reasons why I'm so adamant that people do this work in spiritual practice and meditation practice is because if the critic is there, there's not much inquiry, there's not much investigation. And with mindfulness practice, it has to be integrated with inquiry to deeply understand our experience. We can be aware, but without the investigation, we're not going to go deep into the truth of our experience. And the judgment interferes with that. So cultivating kindness with ourselves, right? The love and kindness practice, essential, beautiful antidote to the critic. You know, I often tell people, I say, and every time you judge yourself, you just add a metta phrase, a loving kindness phrase. So if you're beating yourself up because your meditation was really distracted, and you say, well, may I be happy. Yeah, but you came to class late, and you're always late, you're such a loser, may I be peaceful. Yeah, but you know, you're never going to get your life together. I mean, look at you, you know, just a wreck, and may I be peaceful. And you just you're neutralizing the critic by, in the metta practice is cultivating neural pathways, right? The critic is the very deep neural pathways of self-judgment. And so with metta, we're cultivating kind neural pathways. And then sometimes that force of love manifests as love can with some power, with some strength, right? Just as if your child or your spouse or friend was being attacked or insulted or harshly criticized and unfairly judged by somebody, you wouldn't just sit there and go, just noticing. No, you would probably step up and intervene and say something and say, wait a minute, this is not helpful, this is not constructive, not useful, or some other kind of interaction, right? You wouldn't just be passive, you would engage. In the same way we can draw on that force of love and self-compassion to say no, like enough talking to myself with such harshness. You know, this was a big shift in my relationship to my critic. I was, you know, some years into my practice and I was meditating and my critic was very loud, very active, and I was on my case about something. And instead of just sitting back, listening to the critic and sort of mildly agreeing and yes, I'm a bad person, yes, I shifted my attention to my heart to feel how painful it was to be on the receiving end of that judgment. In the same way, if you think about, even if we get a slight knock, a slight critique in an email, right? It lands, it's painful. It's hard to be criticized. And if we do that a lot and harshly, right? It's having its impact. The heart becomes tender. It's a sore. So we want to feel how that judgment is landing. Because it's not until we confront and be with the suffering that we're likely to actually find that compassionate response, that compassionate action that says, no, enough, a different way to be. Not helpful, not truthful. Thank you. Go bother somebody else, as Jack likes to say. Sometimes it's useful to see, reflect on whose voice is that? Sometimes it's very obvious, like someone said, oh, mom, dad, priest, rabbi, school teacher, somebody influential person in my life that's, you know, we internalize those voices, right? So many other strategies, I'm not going to go into all of them, but just to think about, you know, fundamentally to begin to, I mean, not to begin to, because I'm sure you've looked at this already, but to really make this part of your practice. How does your mind, how do you talk to yourself? When you notice you're distracted in meditation and you come back to the breath, what is the tone of that coming back? Oh, God, thinking again. Like, is it kind of like, you know, you're dragging a dog, you know, on a leash, you know, get back here and sit and stay, you silly, right? Because sometimes we like that, like, oh, as if we've done something wrong. It's like, oh, the mind spaces out. Thoughts think themselves. What a surprise. And we forgive and we come back. We forgive and we come back. And we make intention and we come back. And we space out and we come back. Right? That's the same practice. Practice of recognizing, releasing, letting go. So over time, and what I've seen with myself and others, just like with working with any mind stream, is that over time we become less interested in the whole thing. In that, the critical voice might not go away. I see it often diminish in people, just like our thoughts can have less pull on us in meditation. But it may not disappear, as much as we'd like that judging voice to disappear. But what's key is, with anything in practice, is what our relationship is to it. Can I find some ease or space in relationship to it so I'm no longer bothered by it? I'm not so longer impacted and affected by it. So we can have that lightness or that humor or that spaciousness. So to reflect for yourself, where am I in relationship to that voice, and how much freedom or spaciousness do I have, or how much feeling of kind of being assaulted and gripped by it? Because the extent that we are, the extent that we'll suffer. This is from Janine Roth, writes, "For some reason, we are truly convinced that if we criticize ourselves, the criticism will lead to change. If we are harsh, we believe we will end up being kind. If we shame ourselves, we believe we end up loving ourselves. It has never been true, not for a moment, that shame leads to love. Only love leads to love." So we bring together our practice of kindness, of awareness, of humor, playfulness. I like to think of, you know, being a meditator like a Tai Chi master, where we're fluid with what's coming at us, whether it's politically, with the chaos that's happening in our current administration, or it's our internal forces and voices and thoughts. Can we find some fluidity with that, some spaciousness? Okay, so that's enough words for now, but I'm curious to hear if there's any questions or comments or observation. What's happening out there in the realm of your judging mind? Anybody like to say? Questions? Yes, over here. Are we going to get a mic? Yeah, great.
I have a question about the inner critic. Do you find in your own practice and in your own experience that sometimes the areas in which you're actually pretty good or have some talent or aspiration that the inner critic is then the loudest?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's a good observation. I think what we care about particularly is where our critic will show up. And if we are good at something or excelling at something or we're passionate about something, then yes, the critic will be woven into that because of the care, because of the investment of self, right? So the critic in a way is protecting a sense of identity, right? Upholding a certain identity. And so to that extent, it will be embroiled, and to the extent may undermine that very capacity.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes, question over here, or comment over here, to my right, in the front, to your right.
What if our inner critic becomes an outer critic?
What if it does? Yes, it will probably definitely do that.
Like what you were saying, how it's woven in,
right,
on what we're interested in. So an example can be, I teach inner city children,
mm-hmm,
and my students are predominantly Black and treated with a lot of disrespect.
Mm-hmm.
And When I criticize, I tend to criticize people blind from that.
Mm-hmm.
And it's hard to have the space of compassion because I feel like what Tara said 2 weeks ago, even a good dog, if it's backed up in a corner, will bite you.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes I feel like my inner critic becomes my outer critic, and I also feel cornered. And I just want to bite every single ignorant white supremacist.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and yeah, see, like, so with that, like, how can I be a peaceful person? There's no peace in that space.
Mm-hmm.
There's a rightness, there's an ego.
Mm-hmm.
There's me wanting to do the same thing to the colonizer. And then there's that. So there's no compassion there.
Mm-hmm.
And how do you reach that from the inner critic if it never goes away? Then the external critic never goes away.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it just cycles.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Sorry, I know it's like really intense.
Well, it's complex. You know, there's a lot of layers in there. And, you know, I think that the key point for me in that is, you know, discerning the wisdom in your perception, where there's a lot of wisdom in what you're seeing, right? Whether it's, you know, say white privilege, for example, right? So acknowledging the accuracy of the perception and the reality that is perceived versus how you approach and deal with that and how you confront that and what you say and how you say it. Being mindful of where it's coming from. Is it coming from reactivity? Right, there's wisdom in the seeing, but is the responding to it coming from reactivity and judgment, or is it coming from wisdom without reactivity? Right? And that's the balance we walk, you know, especially in social change work, where you're confronting a lot of suffering and injustice and blindness, right? And then there's frustration and impatience with, say, you know, people's ignorance. And if we have developed our own inner critic and judgmental about our own limitations, it's going to come out, whether it's personal or political. Right? It's the same tendency. So, and what the downside for that, say, in your context, is the more reactivity in the way that you express that, the less it will be received, right? The more the wisdom can come out without that reactivity and judgment, the more likely someone's going to be able to hear what you're saying. So, generally, it's up for, you know, for you and for all of us to do our work around to see, you know, to understand that relationship of inner and outer judgment, and to practice both seeing the limitation, the suffering of that, and to ask, you know, in each situation, is there another way to be? Is another way to say this? Is another way to act without that? But it's not easy. This is not easy. But thanks for your work. Yeah, you know, and you're human, so you know the frustration with that situation, or the impatience, or the, I'm not saying that's there, but some flavor of that. You know, it's understandable. So, and again, there can be truthfulness in the judgment, but the judgment rarely leads to useful resolution if it's toned with that negativity and reactivity. Yeah. Other questions, comments, hand? Oh, up here. Hi. Hi there. Oh, look at that. Mike's just appeared.
Hello, hello, hello. So my question, the inner critic right now is having me notice that I have a question that's connected to yours, and I'm aware that I racially show up as one of the few black women in the room, but here's my question. What about when the inner critic shows up as sort of humility or safety? So specifically, you know, a lot of what people who love me taught me is that you, as a black woman, it is smart to be less visible in certain situations.
Sure.
And to not draw attention. And
you look,
there's many examples of that being wise advice and guidance.
Yes.
And then there's also an element that's connected to the idea of humility, right? Mm-hmm. So sometimes the inner critic can come in my mind, you know, around like, well, who are you? And, you know, this, it's not you, it's grace, it's God, it's universe, it's not you. And so be humble before your favor or your, you know, good fortune is taken from you because of ego, hubris, or arrogance. So how do you navigate when the inner critic comes at you in that way?
Ah, I don't know. As a white man, I don't know. My first response. I appreciate the question. So I think I need to hear a little more to give you an accurate response. So say a little more about the second piece. So I get the wisdom, you know, as a black woman, the need at times to be very discerning about how you show up because we live in a racist culture. So, but I wasn't tracking the second piece of the question in relation to the critic.
Yes, so thank you for being so thoughtful in this exchange. The second piece is about training around humility, that there's, and some of this may come from religious doctrines, cultural practices, but the idea that it is inappropriate, it is unwise, it is arrogant to be fully, you know, grounded in owning all of your power or all of your gifts, that if you are sort of, you know, if you don't question your ability in some way, you are practicing hubris, and that is, you know, depending on what room you're in, sinful or impolite. You know, there's a lot of different ways that the idea of not questioning oneself, I've seen it be framed as a negative, as a weakness. So, is that helpful?
Yeah, kind of. I'm still some things I'm not getting. But so let me paraphrase just to make sure I'm getting it right. So you're saying that whether it's a, you know, cultural or spiritual framework of being humble, are you talking about that in the context of that being advocated as a positive thing or as a negative thing?
Did you ever see the movie The Devil's Advocate? Al Pacino, anyway, whatever. It's not working as a reference.
No, but I'll watch it.
But one of the it's good to watch. But the idea that, like, you know, arrogance is one of the seven deadly sins, right? Okay. The idea that those of people who are without any sense of humility, there's some examples playing out now on the national stage,
that
that those are dangerous people, that those are people who are outside of alignment with spirit, with God, if that's your belief system.
Right.
You know?
Right.
That ego is the way that evil and negativity can sort of sink its teeth into a person if they are ego-driven.
Right. Yeah. So I'm still... So, and the question about in relationship to the critic is what?
Because for me, a lot of times the critic, who are you to think you, you know, who am I to be able to do... There's some things I've done that, you know, are, if I notice, are impressive, right? Uh-huh. And I impress other people. But so what comes up for me is...
Who are you to be so big?
Yeah, it's about that.
The critic can go many different ways. It can go... So, and here's an interesting thing. Basically, we either go towards the grandiosity spectrum or the deflation spectrum, inflation, deflation. Either way, it's a sort of ego distortion, and the critic can be on a case about either one, inflation or deflation. And we want to see how the critic weaves itself into either end of the spectrum. Oh, look at me, I'm so humble. Or who do you think you are, so humble? Or look at me, so successful, and who do you think you are, so successful, right? It can go whichever way. So we just want to be mindful of the different flavors, right? And then we have our own cultural, spiritual conditioning that will emphasize one's better than the other, right? It's okay to be humble but not big. Or another culture, it's okay to be big but not humble, right? So we just want to be present to the whatever flavor the voice has and to see how it's either distorting or undermining. Yeah. Hope that was helpful. All right. I'm mindful of time, so thank you for your presence and your questions, and I wish you to be free of the inner critic. I will stay behind to sign copies of the book, Make Peace With Your Mind. And a pleasure to be here with you. Thank you.